This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, our show also streams. It is filed as a podcast after we broadcast and stream. And that just reminds us that so much of what we do these days is online. And if you spent time on social media, you've probably found name-calling and trolling. Quite a lot of us, as a matter of fact. And in his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, which is a pretty attention-getting title, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up, author James Hogan aims to bring clarity and to explain why we're prone to consider someone who doesn't vote like us, for example, as an enemy. Hogan says in some cases, fact-based arguments don't help either. He spoke with Ashley Thornburg.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So there's already a second edition of this book, and it just came out in 2016. So a quick overview of why did you write the book in the first place, and what's behind an update so recently, so quickly?
Well, I'm a public relations consultant, and I've been involved in helping clients deal with difficult public issues for, like, my whole career. And I've noticed starting in about, 2005, that that there seemed to be a kind of a warlike tone started to develop in public issues, particularly around environment and climate change. And so I started to look at it, and I'd always been, as a public relations person, interested in the whole area of propaganda. And the closer I looked at this problem, the more I realized that it wasn't just people misinforming the public or spreading misinformation, but there was almost like a tribalizing nature to the what I considered kind of a polluted public discourse. And it seemed to me that people were willing to go to incredible ends. You know, Noam Chomsky, when I interviewed him for my book, said, you know, if you can't win an argument, shriek, you know, scream, and, you know, do anything you possibly can to avoid having to defend an argument that you can't defend. And so that's what I was seeing. And it was almost like there was this attack on public discourse itself, so that it wasn't just that people were misinforming folks about the dangers of climate change, but they're basically trying to undermine the whole idea of objectivity, so that facts and opinions almost blended into being the same things. And one of the ways of doing that is through name-calling and attacking the credibility of climate scientists. And so that's basically why I just wanted to take a deeper look at this social pathology that we're all seeing unfold so vividly every night on the news.
You have this terrifying quote that is, we keep slipping into this false idea that evidence will change people's minds. And the book deals largely, of course, with the political discourse and specifically, like you said, around climate science. And I just wonder, when we talk about things like this that are fact-based, why can't we use fact-based arguments with some people?
Well, I think one of the things that I actually am kind of embarrassed about that I didn't know about when I started on this journey in 2005 was that it was something that a fellow named Jonathan Haidt pointed out to me. He spent a lot of time looking at the psychology of teams. And he says that when we join teams, it's something that's quite natural for people to separate off into communities, and there's a lot of good things that come of it. But sometimes when we join teams, we unite against other teams, and we become blinded to the truth. And when people engage in the psychology of teams like this, especially when you're dealing with feelings of anger and hate and resentment, open-minded thinking just shuts down. So it doesn't matter if you're talking about fact. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. The other person is not listening if they think you're on the other team.
Right.
So the problem with that is that you cannot make good public policy decisions in a world where everything is so polarized and tribalized that the first thing you do is try to determine whose side the other person is on before you even think about what they're saying.
Well, yeah, you talk about, you have this quote in the book, if you behave like my enemy, you are my enemy. And you are making the argument that let's just take voting in this case. And I'll use myself as an example. There is this woman that I used to interact with on a regular basis. We did the same kind of physical activities. We hung out in the same places. We ate the same food, you know, and I was like, oh, I love this girl. And then all of a sudden we had this political conversation where I thought, wow, we're just like, we're totally opposite. And in my brain, I sort of went, can I even like this person anymore? And that's not a good way to do that, because obviously I did like this person. And we just don't come to the same conclusions politically is all. But you're trying to make the argument in the book that people can arrive to a vastly different viewpoint from you, and they're not bad people.
Yes. It's the thing that I found really interesting as I was doing this was I was, say just looking at climate change, just not because I'm so particularly interested in climate change, it's just that it's such a good example because basically you have all the evidence there, right? And the arguments against it, you essentially have no evidence on the other side. You have essentially the entire world's scientific communities, all the big scientific academies in the world think that we're warming the climate in a dangerous way. And yet there's a significant percentage of people who don't buy it, who think it's some kind of conspiracy and whatever. So when you look at that process, it's even though some people are right on the evidence, when you're wrong on the way you treat the person who's disagreeing with you and you assume that their intentions are wrong, that kind of gets us into almost what you could call an advocacy trap, where it's almost like you feel like it's David and Goliath, and you're fighting these evil forces. But the fact is that a person can be totally wrong about something and still be a good person.
Right.
And when you tribalize science, when you massage us and them meaning into science, open-mindedness shuts down. It's almost like the people who appeal to that way of thinking are essentially trying to increase the unreasonableness in their group.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, and then you run into that. And so I think rather than thinking that it's an argument about facts that someone is choosing to ignore, it's better to work at trying to open up the space first, so you can have the conversation, because the space doesn't exist when you've tribalized the issue.
Well, you have a very, what I would call, spiritual approach to good communication.
Well, it's interesting because as I looked at it closer, I was talking to all sorts of social scientists and political scientists and really interesting people around the world, and I started to realize there was a kind of a moral aspect to this when I met a woman named Karen Armstrong. She has written a book on the power of compassion. I think she won the TED Prize in 2008, and they gave her this money and to make the world a better place, and she decided to spend $200,000 on writing this book on compassion and on the golden rule. And one of the things that she said to me was that people make a mistake when they assume, when they think of these kind of spiritual, like the spiritual message behind the golden rule of, you know, treating other people the way you'd like to be treated, that kind of advice, which is common to all spiritual traditions, is essentially practical advice to people who lived in dangerous times of how to deal with people who strongly disagree with you. And sort of learning that lesson of the golden rule is not necessarily a religious thing or a spiritual thing. It's really practical advice. It's just that we've come to think of it that way.
Interesting. I like that, actually.
She said, we must speak out against injustice, but not in a way that causes more hatred. Remember what St. Paul said, what was it, something like, good people take no delight in the wrongdoing of others. And so this idea that just because you're right, that you it gives you all of these sorts of privileges over someone who's clearly wrong, is not a good way to kind of overcome this kind of this polarization or this closed-mindedness. You need to be more skilled at kind of opening up the space that the other person trusts you.
What are those skills and habits of excellent communicators?
Well, I think being more aware of the triggers in you, the emotional triggers that drive that take us to that place where our mind closes, being aware of it in ourselves and in the way we trigger it in other people. We know people like that. We're like that ourselves with our kids. This isn't something that's this is not like a superpower, right? But so I think just being aware of it helps. I remember when I interviewed the Dalai Lama for the book. At the end of the interview, we stood up and they turned the cameras off, and he pointed his finger at my forehead and he said, we like to think that the Western mind is more sophisticated, but in Tibet, we go with the heart, and sometimes that's stronger. So maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart together, we can have more success. What we need is more compassion, more warm-heartedness. Yeah. And I think that is a huge lesson. It's in this kind of this willingness, this kindness, even without giving up on what you strongly believe in. This is not an easy thing to do because you want to create common ground while you still stand your ground. You can't give up on reality or on what's right. But how do you stand your ground at the same time that you open up the conversation? And I think a warm-heartedness is the beginning of it.
How can we practice this in a world where politicians troll each other on Twitter?
Yeah. Well, personally, I think one of the things is don't participate in it. You know, don't engage in conversations that really essentially are not going to take you anywhere. It was interesting because I just put a notice up on my Facebook about the new book, and it's got a quote on it. And the conversation, which doesn't include me because I've just watched it, has been going on with maybe 50 people that are having this fight about whether or not climate change is real. And you know for sure that this is basically a conversation of no consequence. No one is going to change their mind. It's just going to keep. And so I think that is those kinds of conversations we want to avoid. I think it's better to have a conversation more about what people are concerned about and try to open up the space where you can, and I think part of it starts with listening to the other person and trying to get a sort of a sense of how they're feeling and why, and building trust with them so that they actually feel like you really are listening to them and not disrespecting them in the way that they expect you to.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a substantial difference between the discourse that's happening in the U.S. And then with your native Canada? Are there big differences in how these discussions, debates, discourse, argument, whatever it happens to be, play out?
Yeah, there is. But it's not as big a difference as you would think. I mean, the president has taken this type of discourse to a whole new level of name-calling and demonizing, and it's shocking. But he's not the first person to be doing this. This kind of stuff has been going on, just not in such a high-profile way. So in Canada, there's a little bit more, don't know if I'd call it politeness. I don't think that's probably or civility. But there is a kind of the kind of unyielding one-sidedness exists here too. And it, you know, a lot of the time it's just not on the front page of your national newspaper. It's more hidden away in some corner of Facebook. But it's still here, and this is like a human blind spot. And I know a number of years ago when I was just starting to write the book, I had spent an afternoon with a Vietnamese monk named Thich Nhat Hanh, and we were talking about the environment. And he said, David Suzuki, who's a Canadian scientist, environmentalist, was part of the conversation. And Thich Nhat Hanh looked at us and he said, "You don't need to tell people they're destroying the planet. They know they're destroying the planet. You need to deal with the despair." And I said, "You're not suggesting that, you know, environmentalists shouldn't be advocates, are you?" And he looked at me. He has this way, you know. He's really quite an amazing man.
Yeah.
And
brilliant,
he looked
author.
At me. He looked at me, and it felt like he was like peering right into my soul. I was only like 2 feet away from him, and he looked me in the eyes and he said, "Speak the truth, but not to punish."
Hmm.
And I think that is there's so much wisdom in that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I mean? That's a way to sort of look at what I've been talking about here that encapsulates it just in a phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've thought about that virtually every day since he told me that maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah. You've mentioned the word tribalism a couple of times and the impact that can have on our ability to have just good, effective communication. Do we know what's happening in our brains, like the brain scans of these kinds of discussions when somebody just feels threatened?
That's a good question. I think that there's theories, and I don't know how much work that has been done with actually, you know, brain scans. I think a lot of these theories about how the mind-brain works aren't based in this kind of brain scan work. But I know that one of the theories is this theory that is developed by a guy named Dan Kahan at Yale Law School, and he's part of this group that studies what they describe as cultural cognition, which is this idea that he said it's almost like we want to be misled. You know, if we're absorbed in this, if we're engaged in this cultural cognition, what we do is if something comes along that contradicts the beliefs of our group, we don't change our beliefs, no matter how much evidence there is, we actually change the evidence to fit the beliefs of our group. And so he said you get to a point where you actually want to be misled. And I think there are a lot of people who think that the part of the brain called the amygdala, which is kind of the fight or flight part of the brain, is what's responsible for that. That when this part of the brain gets activated, the frontal cortex, which is responsible for thinking, shuts down. And so they've studied that. And so there's something going on there. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but there are physical changes that happen in this kind of tribal way that we have of misinterpreting evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in a world of social media, too, where we'll pick on Facebook because it's so big. Your opinion gets echoed back to you so quickly because that algorithm changes depending on what you interact with. And so we end up in sort of these silos of our thought, and then it's just reflected back at us to the point that we can be completely taken aback when something else happens or the other viewpoint.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I was surprised to learn and I find really terrifying is the way these algorithms work.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to favor negative emotions. So not on purpose, but just kind of inadvertently. So because they in the early days of the internet they wanted it to be free. So in order to pay for it, they had to sell eyeball time to advertisers. So they developed these algorithms that would basically be involved in mass surveillance and manipulation of people. And so we're getting more aware of it, but the amount of surveillance is really quite terrifying. And what happens, though, in the surveillance is that these algorithms have decided that it's the negative emotions like resentment and anger and fear that will drive more eyeballs. And so compassion, love, and happiness, and these other positive emotions, they're slower. So it goes with so essentially you get your news feed is full of this stuff that the algorithm is giving you that essentially is not good for you, right? And so it sort of enlivens that part of the brain that doesn't work very well dealing with complicated social issues and public policy issues. So we basically have this kind of mass surveillance and manipulation machine that was used in Brexit and used in the 2016 presidential election that kind of works in, you know, kind of hand in glove with this approach to propaganda that I was talking about earlier. And so the dark side is having an easier time than people who are trying to bring evidence and facts onto the front burner.
Yeah, that old curse, may you live in interesting times. We're visiting with Jim Hogan, the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up, the recently revised edition. Jim, how did you get all of these interviews? You've dropped a few big names in this conversation.
Right, and I was surprised. Well, I was when I was doing this, I was chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, and I was also chair of Al Gore's climate project in Canada. And I had started a blog called Desmog Blog that was quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these people knew me, and then others I just met through boards that I was on the board of the Dalai Lama Center. And so it was kind of good luck in many ways, right? But David Suzuki's name opens up a lot of doors. Mm. So I think that was mainly the reason that I got these people's attention.
Yeah. Speaking of the Desmog blog and the work with prominent environmentalist David Suzuki, I am wondering, though, because you also run a PR firm, and among your clients is Shell Canada, one of Canada's largest integrated oil companies. And so you're doing all this work with environmental advocacy and then also representing a fossil fuel industry. I'm not even sure how to ask that question, but how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, and so the work that I've done with them is really not public relations work in the traditional sense. It's more setting up dialogues with environmental groups and scientists. So, you know, I don't do traditional public relations where I'm trying to defend the indefensible. It's more getting them to sit down and, you know, meet with people like David Suzuki and other Canadian and European environmental groups.
Okay. Jim, thank you so much for your time today. I wish we had more.
Well, thank you.
That was James Hogan, author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. The book, now in its second edition, is available from Amazon. He spoke with our Ashley Thornburg. Coming up on Main Street, Prairie Public Scott Prebis performs Wednesday with Kansas City jazz artists, and the New York Kammermusiker is wrapping up its North Dakota tour. They'll be at the Chehinkapa Zoo in Wahpeton on Tuesday to play with Tal the orangutan. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. An interim legislative committee is studying the distribution and transportation of food in rural communities. As Prairie Public's Dave Thompson reports, it isn't an easy issue to solve.
The study came from concerns about the loss of grocery stores in smaller cities. Lori Capo is the Rural Development Director for the North Dakota Rural Electric and Telecommunications Development Center.
When we started this work in 2014, we documented 137 full-service stores in towns with 2,100 people or less. As of today, there are 98 stores remaining.
Capel told the Interim Commerce Committee some of these stores are operated by the communities themselves or are staffed by volunteer help.
Rural people work hard to keep their grocery store. They understand they need it. It's a pillar in their community. They feel it's a kiss of death for their community to lose it.
Capel says other states are facing the same issues. And she says studies have shown that people who don't have access to fresh fruit, vegetables, and meat are more likely to develop health problems. But solutions aren't easy.
There isn't a silver bullet. These issues are deep.
Karen Ahrens represents the group Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota. She told the committee,
from my perspective, it's going to take the public sector, the private sector, and the nonprofit sector working together.
Melissa Sobolik is executive director of the Great Plains Food Bank. Her agency also administers the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which used to be known as the Food Stamp Program. She says only 60% of income-eligible North Dakotans sign up for SNAP.
One reason they don't participate, which we hear a lot from our rural residents, is that they don't have anywhere locally to use their SNAP benefits. They don't have a local grocery store.
Sobolik says last year, over $74 million in SNAP benefits was distributed to 53,000 North Dakotans.
Having a local grocery store that accepts SNAP benefits not only improves the nutrition of our low-income residents, but it's a guaranteed customer base for our rural grocers.
A lot of the committee discussion was about transportation issues, that is, getting fresh food to rural grocery stores. And committee members wondered what role the state can play when it comes to any solutions. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And the president of the Independent Community Banks of North Dakota says his members are increasingly concerned about the continued slump in the agriculture economy.
You know, we went into this cycle coming off a tremendous cycle in agriculture, and balance sheets are strong, and, you know, there's been restructuring of debt and things of that nature. But some of those tools, somewhat running out of tools as far as restructuring operating debt to real estate or other medium and long-term assets.
Barry Haugen says his organization's 60 members, two-thirds are of his organization's 60 members, two-thirds are still chartered in cities of less than 8,000 people. He says the local bankers have been doing whatever they can for farmers.
Community banking is relationship banking, and these are not just customers, but friends and neighbors, and I think community bankers do a tremendous job, particularly in our state, of working with their producers. And I'm sure there are difficult conversations that are had, but I'm certainly not hearing that they're severing ties or kicking producers out of the bank. I'm just not hearing that.
The organization is holding its annual conference in Bismarck this week. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Senator Kent Conrad, wishing his wife, Lucy Caluti, a very happy birthday.
Well, that's obviously a little bit of jazz, which sets up the discussion we're going to have right now with Scott Prebus. You hear him on Prairie Public and Prebus on Jazz, Saturdays at 7 Central, and Prebus on Classics, weekdays at 10 to noon. And, of course, he's also a performer. So, Scott, who did we just hear?
Well, another one of those great Kansas City saxophonists, Doug Talley. You know, there are hundreds of great saxophonists in KC. And he is certainly one of them. From his CD called Kansas City Suite, his homage, if you would, to Count Basie and the Prez, called Basie and the Prez. The Prez is Lester Young, a Kansas City musician. Count Basie, although originally from New Jersey, made Kansas City his home.
All right, so you are a fountain of information about jazz, obviously, because you do a show, and you've got a special show coming up in Bismarck, live music, a night of great jazz, Kansas City jazz meets Bismarck jazz. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I've been going to Kansas City for about 20-some years, a couple times a year, about 2 weeks a year, and it only takes one trip to Kansas City to find out what a great jazz heritage emanates from there, and it is a town that is, I still think, one of the greatest jazz cities in the world. I mean, every night there's jazz everywhere. And you become, you get to the point where you love it, and I certainly absolutely love every minute that I'm in Kansas City. And I wanted to bring a little bit of the KC sound here to the upper Midwest so people had a chance to hear it. It's very unusual. It swings. It's very lyrical. And it's music you tap your foot to.
A night of great jazz, Kansas City Jazz meets Bismarck Jazz Wednesday at 7 o'clock outside at Sleepy Hollow Arts Park at the gazebo. You can bring a blanket and or a lawn chair if you'd like. And tell us about the performers. You're the drummer.
Actually, I'm playing drums on this one. And one of the Bismarck musicians is a great bass player by the name of Darren King. Darren is illustrious in his quite a formidable sound on the bass. And then we're bringing up four artists from Kansas City. Jim Mayer has been there for well over two decades. Great saxophonist. Teaches at Kansas City, Kansas Community College, has developed a great program there. The guitarist is Rod Fleeman, who is a Grammy Award-winning guitarist. Rod generally, when he's not on the road, is playing six nights a week, but on any given week he might be in Paris, he might be in London playing a magnificent guitar player. On keyboards, Mr. Justin Binnick. And Justin hasn't lived in Kansas City that long, but has adapted himself very well to the Kansas City sound. Justin is a Bismarck native and now living in Kansas City. And the attraction is Ebony Fondren. Ebony, very smooth. Velvety voice, and she swings, but I guess I would call her the female version of the Velvet Fog.
Oh, Mel Torme.
Right.
Yeah, right. Well, this sounds like a great lineup. The tickets are $12 in advance, $15 at the door, and you can get them at Prairie Public, Eckroth Music, and Direct Travel. And you've talked about Kansas City jazz having this certain sound to it. When you're performing with experienced jazz pros like you're going to have in Sleepy Hollow Arts Park on Wednesday, how much is on the music sheet and how much is improvised?
You know, Darren has been asking me for a couple weeks about music, and I just keep telling him, don't worry about it.
You're a jazz artist, after all.
And the three guys are driving up because they're bringing their amps and pianos and things like that. So they're driving up. Ebony is flying in tomorrow, but they're driving up. And they'll determine what the program is as when they're probably 100 miles out of Bismarck.
So they'll be improvising on the road.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They all know the tunes. It's very uncanny to play with them in Kansas City because, sure, we'll do this tune and let's do it. What key do you want to do it in? Let's do it in A-flat. And they are proficient in all keys and know hundreds and hundreds of tunes off the top of their head. So I know Darren will be very attentive because our rehearsal will be probably an hour. We'll start the beginning, we'll work on the ending, and then the middle is improvised. And the guys from Kansas City, Doug, I would say, have what we call big ears.
Well, you better explain that to me.
Yeah, they listen very intensely. Uh-huh. So you know what the dynamic level is at the start, at the end of the solo. You know exactly when they're going to end a solo. You have to listen to how they're going to end the tune. There's five or six standard endings on tunes, and they do this every night. They know exactly what they're going to do, but it's all done with listening. And that's part of the story of Count Basie. Count Basie, they say, carried his band's library in his back pocket. I've talked to a couple of alums of that orchestra, and what that means is that they have some sheet music, but that's so written over and penned over and erased that you have to use your ears. And they create riffs and background figures right on stage. You have to listen and just join in. But there is nothing like it in the world. Kansas City is one of the most unique jazz cities. You know, in jazz, we talk so much about New Orleans. And I would say right behind that is Kansas City, because the whole big band sound coming from the 30s, the Pendergast era, had a lot to do with that. And, you know, jazz always seems to flourish in an illegal background, you know.
And speakeasies and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. It happened in New Orleans. It happened in Kansas City. It certainly happened in Chicago. And it seems to flourish. Well, it's all legal now in KC, but the tradition is still there.
Well, the interesting experience for the audience, I think, because I have taken in a fair amount of jazz, I'm no expert by any means, is that it's always different. There's this part that's improvised, and, you know, somebody can get into a really neat riff and go for a while.
Well, back in the day, they tell me we keep our tunes to about 7 minutes each, so we get a wide variety of tunes. So they're which means in terms of improvisation, you would take 3 or 4 choruses. But they tell me back in the day, in the 30s and 40s in Kansas City, it wouldn't be unusual for a tenor player to take 14 to 20 choruses.
Wow.
You know, they would just go on, and especially if there was a battle of the band.
And if people are getting up and getting into it.
And dancing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, dancing. The floor is going to be concrete. I don't think we're going to have much dancing, but very listenable, toe-tapping stuff, and you just seem to escape into the music. I've never quite heard anything like that. It's just when you watch a Kansas City audience, they're drumming their fingers, they're tapping their foot, nodding their head. They just jump right in.
Well, you've been playing music for a long time, jazz for a long time, and you taught it as well. So how do you teach jazz?
Well, I think one of the key things is that you teach people to listen, because so much music is taught through the sheet music, what's on the page. And sheet music, as you know, is like reading a foreign language. The more you do of it, the better you get. And reading the sheet music is just like speaking a second language. But in jazz, the emphasis is not on the composer, but on the performer. And it's the creative aspect of you play through the head to the tune, the melody to the tune, they call it. And then you create music. You're the composer for that 4 minutes or so that you're improvising. And a lot of people who study sheet music over the years find that they have a hard time expressing themselves when somebody says, take a solo, take it. It's
sure.
yours.
Yeah, it's not on the paper.
Right. And it's like, what do I do? You know, and that's why they excel so much at it. It's such a creative, when you listen to Beethoven with some degree, it's going to be the same with various inflections and interpretations. But jazz is different every time you listen to it.
Now, you mentioned that these people who are coming up from Kansas City for a night of great jazz, Kansas City Jazz meets Bismarck Jazz Wednesday at the Sleepy Hollow Arts Park, 7 o'clock that evening. You're saying that they're going to be kind of deciding what's going to be played, what the set will be. Does that mean that there'll be some numbers that people will recognize? I mean, they're kind of universal jazz favorites, that kind of thing, and some will be new stuff to most of the audience?
Well, I did. I know there will be several tunes that are Kansas City hits from Benny Moten and Count Basie, Kansas City Shout, Shiny Stockings, another one. That when you go out on the road and represent Kansas City, that's definitely in the repertoire. We have no idea what Ebony's going to sing yet. I've heard her sing. I've worked with her once. She's delightful, but she'll bring some charts.
So, and you and Darren King representing Bismarck. So occasionally you're going to burst into a little drum solo, right?
Scott? Okay.
And Darren will be doing a little bass solo?
Yeah, I'm hoping Darren will be doing more bass soloing than me drumming. But,
come on. So how is support for jazz among the audience in Bismarck? I've seen it actually kind of growing around here.
I think it was very big about 15 years ago. We had a jazz society, as did a Fargo-Moorhead. And then tastes change and things change. And I think we're bringing it back a little bit. I have been amazed at the interest in tickets so far. People calling us, should I wear a jacket? Should I bring mosquito repellent? Should I bring a blanket? Or are you going to have, you know, how long is the concert? Normally, audiences just show up, you know.
And it is jazz, after all.
Yeah. But it's going to be as much fun for the audience as I think it is for us, because we're going to at 7 o'clock, we're putting on our ears, and we don't know what's going to happen until we play it. But they have done this thousands of times, and so there won't be any train wrecks. But you put your seatbelt on, you open up your ears, and you listen very carefully, and you have fun. And above all, with Kansas City, you swing.
And there'll be a little presentation at 3:30 in the afternoon on Wednesday at that same venue?
Right. Just about Kansas City, the art of Kansas City jazz. It is unique. It's not like West Coast jazz. It's not like New York. We're only going to do about 20 or 25 minutes on that. But it is such a unique art form that I want people to begin to understand that Kansas City jazz is its own genre.
It's a night of great jazz. Kansas City Jazz meets Bismarck Jazz Wednesday at 7 at Sleepy Hollow Arts Park Gazebo in Bismarck. It's $12 for tickets in advance at Prairie Public, Eckroff Music, and Direct Travel, $15 at the door. Thank you, Scott Prebus.
A pleasure to be on Main Street.
And we'll hear a little more of that wonderful sax on Basie and the Prez.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
There's a special concert tomorrow at the Chehinkapa Zoo in Wahpeton, and it features one of the zoo's star attractions, Tal the Orangutan, performing on recorder with the New York Kammermusiker. The music starts at 4 o'clock at the zoo. 2 years ago, Main Street's Ashley Thornburg took in their collaborative performance.
His colors. We did the instruments early on, claps.
Sounds like any good caregiver talking about any kid. And A.D. Paul is a good caregiver.
He's my boy.
Only she's not talking about kids.
And then we also use a laser light to send him different places in the exhibit.
Paul is the lead zookeeper at Wahpeton's Chehinkapa Zoo.
This is my passion. This is my life.
With 200 species from native animals like elk and bison to exotic species like the fusa, an African cat-like relative of the mongoose, her job keeps her busy.
I love challenges, so animals that challenge me in my training are always on that favorite list for the day.
One in particular loves to keep A.D. Paul on her toes. Talukin, they call him Tal, is a 300-pound orangutan.
He likes to see what he can get away with.
Orangutans are great apes native to Indonesia and Malaysia. They're among the most intelligent of all primates. Tal made his intelligence clear immediately.
He was watching us one day clean his bedrooms with a scrub brush, and some soap had gotten into the bedroom he was in, and he took his arm and he rubbed it in the soap, and we were watching him like, what's going on? And then he looked at us, and then he started using his arm to scrub his mesh for us. And it was the most adorable thing I've ever seen. We were just in awe.
That level of intelligence makes life a little tricky for zoo director Kathy Dickman.
You'll notice around the locks on the doors, there's two locks on every door, three entrances into the habitat. And we have welded plates, metal plates around each lock outside so he doesn't create a tool and start to open things. Safety is always first.
If that sounds like a bit much, consider this escape artist. An orangutan from the Omaha Zoo crawled through air vents and picked a lock with metal he'd hidden in his cheek. Orangutans are also among the most threatened species. Bornean orangutans are endangered. Sumatrans are critically endangered. Palm oil harvesting causes major deforestation of an orangutan's natural habitat. Conservationists like Dickman work to educate visitors.
People say, what can I do, what can I do? Well, one thing is, let's watch what we buy. And people say, well, is that enough? It's a great start. And if everybody did that, or 50% of the people did that, that makes a huge impact.
No, Woody. Sorry, Woody.
Dr. Carmela Llano-Sanchez is a veterinarian and the executive director for the Orangutan Project, a rehab center for these great apes in Indonesia. Indonesia is a poor country, but World Bank data show it's making progress in alleviating poverty, in part because of the increased demand for palm oil. It means more jobs for more people. From an interview in 2015, Llano-Sanchez says the trick isn't eliminating palm oil. It's about buying the right kind.
You know, there is a lot of land with no forest, with no orangutans that they can use for production of palm oil, but instead primary forest and forest containing orangutans are being converted, and that is the problem. So we have to try to change the industry, not to stop it, but try to improve it.
What's happening to the orangutans is right in line with the Chihinkapa Zoo's focus on the plight of the animals in the wild. After more than 5 years of work, the zoo got Tal in 2010.
Those eyes speak everything.
He's an important piece of the zoo's education puzzle. Staff members show off Tal's skills because it keeps visitors curious and informed.
We get a lot of comments about Tal being by himself. And instead of these people going off and commenting on that, they can ask us. We can explain to them that, no, he's solitary in the wild. You know, he's completely fine by himself.
Tal's enrichment training also keeps him engaged. Staffers come up with a battery of games and activities for Tal. And one thing they noticed, he loves music. Musician Alana Peterson is from North Dakota. She now lives in New York and plays regularly with a double reed ensemble she started, New York Kammermusiker.
Everyone seems to want to come to play with us because it's more fun than playing in their major orchestras.
Tal is a big fan. He's not one to sit back and listen. He is hands-on. Learning music is a more complex skill than much of Tal's other training.
We started with the harmonica, actually, and we did the recorder next. That one was a little more difficult because he wanted to suck on it like a straw as opposed to blow. So we actually had to train him how to blow. What we did was we would play a recorder on our end and then give it to him, but then we would also blow in his face a little bit to give him that sensation that you have to blow and not just suck in.
The complexity of the skill didn't seem to faze him much.
He took to it awesome.
And of course, rewards never hurt.
Once he made his first noise, we jackpotted him like crazy. I mean, he got all kinds of treats for that.
One of those treats? Concert seats. Front row, center.
Tal the Orangutan and the New York Kammermusiker performs at Wahpeton's Chihinkapa Zoo tomorrow at 4 p.m. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 12th. Lewis and Clark Reunion Bay is listed as one of North Dakota's tourist attractions. In this park near Newtown, you can camp, picnic, launch your boat, hike, or just relax. There's even a ferry called the Island Girl that makes trips into the bay for people to enjoy the waters of Lake Sakakawea. While the bay and the ferry might be great places for a reunion, the bay actually got its name because Lewis and Clark reunited there on this date in 1806 after separating for a month during the return east. On July 3rd, the party had decided to split up at a spot in Montana they had dubbed Traveler's Rest. Clark headed up the Bitterroot River with 50 horses, 20 men, and Sakakawea and her baby. They searched for the location where they met the Bitterroot Salish tribe a year earlier. Meanwhile, Lewis set out with 9 men down the Bitterroot River to Clark Fork and began heading towards the plains. Things went relatively smoothly for each party until Lewis was hunting for elk with Pierre Cruzat on August 11th. While Lewis was crawling through some bushes, someone shot him. The bullet went through his left thigh below the hip bone, leaving a 3-inch cut on his right buttock. He instantly assumed it was Cruzat, who only had vision in one eye. He called out to him, but heard no answer. Lewis returned to the camp and alerted the men that there might be Indians in the area, but no Indians were found after 20 minutes of panic and searching. Cruzat, perhaps embarrassed, did not admit he did it, but he said if he shot Lewis, it was not his intention. In Lewis's own writing, "I do not believe that the fellow did it intentionally, but after finding that he had shot me, was anxious to conceal his knowledge of having done so." Lewis's injury was not severe, but he was in some pain, and very grateful they found Clark's party the next day, writing that he would desist from writing until he had recovered, leaving it to Clark to continue his journal. So if you're ever camping by Reunion Bay or taking the ferry, sit back, relax, and handle firearms with care. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Before I tell you what's coming up on Main Street on Tuesday, we have a couple of tickets to give away. A member of Prairie Public has given us a set for this weekend's 50th anniversary of Peace and Music that's playing at the Blue Stem Amphitheater south of Moorhead. The 2 tickets each for Friday and Saturday's concert, so quite a giveaway. The event features music from the Woodstock Music Festival of 50 years ago, of course. You can email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org to enter the drawing. And let us know if you want tickets for Friday, Saturday, or both days. And let us know your preference if you pick one. Include, of course, your address. We can mail the tickets out tomorrow, and the winner or winners can stop by Prairie Public to pick them up if they prefer. Tuesday on our show, Zahra Zenkir is a Lebanese-British journalist who writes about the intersection of politics and culture in the Middle East. She compiled and edited a collection titled Our Women on the Ground, Essays by Arab Women Reporting from the Arab World. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.